Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from Washington that the government does not want you to know and that the mainstream media is not reporting. Hey, I've got a terrific show for you today. Our guest today is the person that's supposed to be in charge, the President of the United States, George W. Bush, the guy chosen by the second greatest number of people in America to be president, the person that only got a little more than half a million votes behind the front runner Al Gore, and therefore was proclaimed by the Supreme Court to be President of the United States. That's right. Our guest today is George W. Bush. And I'm very happy that he's going to come on my show. You know, this president does not like to talk to the press. He's given 3 primetime press conferences in 4 years. Clinton had given about 40 by this time, Eisenhower about 80. This president's done 3 primetime press conferences, 12 press conferences totally, and yet he's coming on the Inside Scoop. He's going to answer my questions. And you know what? Unlike most of the press, I'm your host, Mark Levine. You know me. You've heard my show. I don't back down. I don't back down just because he's president of the United States. Here on the Inside Scoop, we ask the tough questions. We don't back down. So while I'm very glad to have President Bush on my show today, I plan to ask him the tough questions. And so does my crack team of reporters. I got a whole host of reporters sitting here by my side going to ask the tough questions of President George W. Bush. And if you want to join in, you want to talk to me, you want to ask some questions, just call right in. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. You can also email me by sending an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. And the first thing I guess I want to do, President Bush, is I want to congratulate you on your endorsement. I understand that John Kerry's been endorsed by most foreign leaders. I mean, certainly France and Germany and Russia and most of Europe and just about everyone around the world, Canada, would rather see John Kerry president. But you received an endorsement just yesterday, President Bush, for your reelection. I want to be the first to congratulate you. And the endorsement was not from a run-of-the-mill European government or democracy. No, no, no. You got an endorsement from an Arab group. And I want to read to you the name of that Arab group and read to you the endorsement. The group is it's kind of hard to read, and I don't speak Arabic. Al-Qaeda. Oh, apparently a group named Al-Qaeda has endorsed President Bush for re-election. And why have they endorsed Bush for re-election? Well, they write, because he acts with force rather than wisdom or shrewdness, and it is his religious fanaticism that will rouse our nation, as has been shown. Well, congratulations, President Bush, on your Al-Qaeda endorsement. We'll see whether that helps you in the campaign. Again, I'll just read that one more time for our listeners. Al-Qaeda has endorsed President Bush, quote, because he acts with force rather than wisdom or shrewdness, and it is his religious fanaticism that will rouse our nation, as has been shown. So congratulations, President Bush. Now, though, I think it's time for you to answer my questions. Are you ready, Mr. President?
Now I'd be glad to take your questions.
Great. I'm really glad. Listen, my question is, Mr. President, first of all, there's been some controversy over the war in Iraq. We have these huge uprisings in Fallujah and throughout the country, and the American people are becoming quite split on the question of whether this was a good idea or not to begin with. What do you have to say to that, Mr. President? What do you have to say about this country being split on that?
The people of our country are united behind our men and women in uniform.
Okay, right. Yeah, well, we all support the troops. And I do. I really have to say from the beginning that I think the people, men and women fighting in Afghanistan, Iraq, putting their lives on the line, doing things, you know, for their country like John Kerry did when he was in Vietnam, like you refused to do, but certainly talk about, you know, giving your life for your country. You know, I certainly think they're doing a good job. I'm really not complaining about them. My question is, what is your government doing, Mr. President? What is the Bush administration doing? What is the government doing to work out this problem in Iraq?
And this government will do all that is necessary to assure the success of their historic mission.
All that is necessary. All right. All that is necessary. Well, that's great, because we're not doing too little. We're doing all. And yet we're not doing too much. We're doing all that is necessary. Thank you. Can you be a little more specific, though?
One central commitment of that mission is the transfer of a sovereignty back to the Iraqi people.
The Iraqi people. Terrific. The Iraqi people. And who will that be?
We have set a deadline of June 30th. It is important that we meet that deadline.
Okay, so you've said when it's going to be. My question is, who is it going to be?
We will not step back from our pledge. On June 30th, Iraqi sovereignty will be placed in Iraqi hands.
Okay, all right, but you've given the date, June 30th. We got that. I assume there'll be some massive ceremony there, okay, but...
Sovereignty involves more than a date and a ceremony.
Okay.
It requires Iraqis to assume responsibility for their own future.
Okay, so we're going to give it to Iraqis. Iraqis are going to assume responsibility for their own future. Well, that's great sounding rhetoric, Mr. President. Tell me who, WHO, who will be in charge in Iraq?
Our coalition is standing with responsible Iraqi leaders as they establish growing authority in their country.
Responsible Iraqi leaders. Okay, all right, responsible Iraqi leaders. Not just any Iraqi, responsible Iraqi leaders. Okay, all right.
The transition to sovereignty requires that we demonstrate confidence in Iraqis. And we have that confidence.
Well, I'm really glad that you have that confidence, Mr. President, but I'm still not quite sure who's going to be controlling Iraq and how is Iraq going to be free?
The nation of Iraq is moving towards self-rule. And Iraqis and Americans will see evidence in the months to come.
All right, so they're moving to self-rule. They're going to rule themselves. I guess they get to decide their own flag. No, I guess we decided that flag, right?
On June 30th, when the flag of Free Iraq is raised, Iraqi officials will assume full responsibility for the ministries of government. On that day, the transitional administrative law, including a Bill of Rights that is unprecedented in the Arab world, will take full effect.
Well, now, Mr. President, I guess I have to argue with that. You say there's a Bill of Rights and it's unprecedented in the Arab world, and yet Syria has a Bill of Rights. They talk about freedom of speech and freedom of religion. They don't actually have freedom of speech or freedom of religion, but they have that Bill of Rights. Do you care to comment on the Syrian Bill of Rights?
No.
Okay, well, how about the Saudi Arabian Bill of Rights or the Egyptian Bill of Rights? You said it's unprecedented. Could you compare the Iraqi Bill of Rights to the ones that occur in Saudi Arabia, where women are not allowed to drive or vote or really do almost anything without their husband? Please, can you explain the difference between those two Bills of Rights?
No.
Please?
I'm sorry.
All right, okay, fine. If you can't, you can't. Let's move on. Tell me again how it's going to work with Iraq. I mean, how do we know that this government will be friendly to the United States if they choose a government on their own?
The United States and all the nations of our coalition will establish normal diplomatic relations with the Iraqi government. An American embassy will open, and an American ambassador will be posted.
Well, that's all well and good, but if they're ruling themselves, how do we know that they're going to accept an American ambassador? How do we know even who will be in charge, Mr. President?
According to the schedule already approved by the Governing Council, Iraq will hold elections for a National Assembly no later than next January.
Now, Mr. President, there have been some that have argued that your schedule for election was changed on purpose. You know, originally you talked about doing elections June 30th. A couple months from now, when you transferred sovereignty to Iraq, and now you moved it 6 months later. Some say that's because you wanted it after the American election. Could you please comment on that?
No.
Well, I think it's a fair charge. I mean, I really think you should at least respond to my question.
No.
Mr. President, please, just answer the question. Why did you move the elections?
I'm sorry.
All right, okay, I'll move on. Tell me again about sovereignty. Explain to me how this is going to work, all right? How will the Iraqis control their own lives?
Once we transfer our sovereignty, we'll enter into a security agreement with the government to which we pass sovereignty, the entity to which we pass sovereignty.
And how do we know that entity to which we'll pass sovereignty, I mean, how do we know that it's going to be friendly to the American government? If they're ruling themselves, how do we ensure that it's not really just a puppet government?
And we'll need to be there for a while.
Okay, well, yeah, I guess we can be there for a while. Who chooses the government again?
We're working closely with the United Nations envoy, Lakhdar Brahimi, and with Iraqis to determine the exact form of the government that will receive sovereignty on June 30th.
Okay, but you've always said you don't want the United Nations involved, that you think that United States policy shouldn't be controlled by the United Nations. How do we decide who runs the government? What is the United Nations going to do? Mr. President, really, I'm sorry to be so confused about this, but could you please explain it to me in the clearest possible way?
The United Nations is over there now. The United Nations representative is there now to work on the onto whom we transfer sovereignty. I mean, in other words, it's one thing to decide it's transfer. We're now in the process of deciding what the entity will look like to whom we will transfer sovereignty. But no, the date remains firm.
Mr. President, you know, I give up. I give up. You're obviously not answering my question. You know, maybe one of the other reporters here can get an answer. Michael, could you please ask the President in a way that apparently he understands?
And, Mr. President, who will we be handing the Iraqi government over to on June 30th?
You'll find that out soon. That's what Mr. Brahimi is doing. He's figuring out the nature of the entity we'll be handing sovereignty over.
Oh, I get it. I get it. It's like a reality show. We can't know who's going to get the sovereignty yet. That would ruin the surprise. We'll find out. Tune in tomorrow. I get it. I get it now. I understand. What I guess I don't understand, though, is John Kerry's been saying all along, we need to get the United Nations involved. And you've attacked him really mercilessly, Mr. President. You've said, you know, that John Kerry would put United Nations interests ahead of America's. And when the United Nations didn't want to go to war with Iraq, you said, you know what, forget the United Nations. We'll go to war anyway. We don't need the United Nations. So now I guess you're pretty much against the United Nations involvement, right? Because for you to support the United Nations, that would be a flip-flop, right, Mr. President?
I think that one of the things you're seeing is more involvement by the United Nations in terms of the political process. That's helpful. I'd like to get another UN Security Council resolution out that will help other nations to decide to participate.
Well, he's a tough guest, folks. President of the United States, I'm trying to get him to answer my questions. I'm doing my best. I'm having a bit of a trouble. But hey, if you want to call in, you want to ask me some questions, find out what the president's got in his mind, call in. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. You can also email me by sending an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. And when we come back with my exclusive interview with George W. Bush, we're going to ask him some really tough questions. Specifically, we're going to ask him about the 9/11 Commission. And I want to know, and my crack team reporters here wants to know, why it is that he can't go it alone. Why it is that he doesn't feel confident to talk alone to the 9/11 Commission. Why he has to have Uncle Dick Cheney by his side. It's a tough question, but that's what we do on the Inside Scoop. We ask the president, we ask the tough questions of the administration. Again, you want to call in, the number is 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be back with Mark Levine and President Bush right after these messages.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner. April 28th is Workers' Memorial Day, commemorating the 33rd anniversary of the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Act. And today, people around the world remember those who have suffered and died on the job. According to government statistics, each year at least 4.7 million U.S. workers are injured or become sick at work. More than 60,000 die from occupational illnesses, and nearly 6,000 are killed on the job. The AFL-CIO is urging OSHA to examine new workplace hazards and increase penalties for companies that repeatedly break OSHA laws.
American companies can mistreat American workers without fear, so long as it takes place outside the country. Such is the conclusion of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in a dispute between two tree trimmers and their former employer, Pennsylvania-based Asplund Tree Expert Company. The two were fired in 1998 while on a job in Canada and stranded there with no way back to the States. When they did return, the two sued Asplund. A district court judge found the company violated U.S. labor law, and the National Labor Relations Board ordered Asplund to reinstate the fired men. But the appeals court ruled it lacks the power to do that. NLRB jurisdiction ends at the border.
According to the latest issue of Newsweek, American troops in Iraq are fatally undersupplied. The lack of heavy tanks and body armor has led to a record 115 U.S. soldier deaths and 879 injuries in April. Some Pentagon officials blame Defense Secretary Rumsfeld's lighter is better military strategy for the lack of adequate equipment in Iraq. A study by an Army defense consultant suggests that of the 686 Americans killed in Iraq so far, one in four might be alive today if they had had stronger armor. By the Army's own estimates, they're about 1,800 heavily armored vehicles short. Almost all U.S. soldier deaths have occurred while in unprotected light-skinned Humvees. The Army says it needs more money to protect its soldiers, and the cost of military operations in Iraq is already topping $4.7 billion a month. Adjusted for inflation, the Vietnam War cost about $5 billion a month.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. All of the information security systems in the world will not stop a bar of chocolate. That's the finding of an informal survey conducted in London recently for a European trade conference on information security. Random samplings of people walking through a subway station found one-third of them would freely disclose their office computer's username and password to a complete stranger, and more than two-thirds of those polled broke down if bribed with candy.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, former congressional attorney, bringing you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know, and bringing you scoops like my exclusive interview with President George W. Bush. Here at the Inside Scoop, we don't let him get away with avoiding the questions. We ask him the tough questions, and my crack team of reporters is here to ask the president the tough questions. And one of the toughest questions that this president has to answer is, why is it that he has to go with Uncle Dick Cheney to the 9/11 commission, which is going to happen tomorrow? Why can't he go alone? Every other president seems to be able to speak on their own. But we've learned from Paul O'Neill, from Bob Woodward, from Richard Clark, that this is a president that very much needs Dick Cheney to hold his hand, very much like any prince or young ruler of a kingdom. He needs to have his advisors by his side to tell him what to say. As Paul O'Neill has written, George Bush doesn't ask questions. He doesn't try to find out what's going on. He mouths what other people have him say. That's quite a harsh charge. And luckily, we've got President Bush here to try to answer that charge, to try to explain why it is that he can't go alone to the 9/11 Commission. And if you want to call in and comment on the show, feel free. The number is 877-57-SCOOP. But now let's get right to the question. Mr. President, I'm going to let one of the other reporters here ask the question because, you haven't been responding to me so well. Michael, could you ask the question of the president, please?
President, why are you and the vice president insisting on appearing together before the 9/11 commission?
Because the 9/11 commission wants to ask us questions. That's why we're meeting, and I look forward to meeting with them and answering their questions.
Why you're appearing together rather than separately, which was their request?
Because it's a good chance for both of us to answer questions that the 9/11 commission is looking forward to asking us, and I'm looking forward to answering them.
But you're not answering the question. Mr. President, wait a minute.
Hold on for a minute.
No, but you got to answer the question. Why do you need Dick Cheney by your side?
I'm sorry.
Okay, I know you have some must calls, but I'm sorry. This is the Inside Scoop. Here we ask you the questions, and here, Mr. President, you answer the questions. So I'm not letting you move on. I'm not letting you move on at all. Michael, ask the question again.
President, why are you and the vice president insisting on appearing together before the 9/11 commission?
It's a simple question, Mr. President. Even you should be able to understand it and reply without stuttering.
Because the 9/11 commission wants to ask us questions. That's why we're meeting, and I look forward to meeting with them.
Yeah, but why are you meeting with Dick Cheney?
Answering their questions.
Why you're appearing together rather than separately, which was their request.
That's the question.
Because it's a good chance for both of us to answer questions that the 9/11 commission is looking forward to asking us, and I'm looking forward to answering them.
You're still not answering the
Let's
question.
See.
Mr. President, don't move
on.
Well, no, but you can't answer the question. Look, Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. I've got some must calls. I'm sorry.
Okay. All right. Fine. Fine. Let's move on. If you're not going to answer the question, let's just make it clear that you obviously cannot explain why you can't do anything by yourself. You know, I got to tell you something, Mr. President. Most of our presidents, right or wrong, at least could, you know, go to the bathroom without someone holding their hand, could talk about what they were doing. Not you. No, no. You've got to have Dick Cheney, and you can't even explain yourself. You know what? I give up. Susan, ask him a question, something else about the 9/11 Commission. I can't respond right now.
Move to the 9/11 Commission. You yourself have acknowledged in the that Osama bin Laden was not a central focus of the administration in the months before September 11th. I was not on point, you told the journalist Bob Woodward. I didn't feel that sense of urgency. 2.5 years later, do you feel any sense of personal responsibility for September 11th?
Here's what I feel about that. The person responsible for the attacks was Osama bin Laden. That's who's responsible for killing Americans.
Okay, okay, Mr. President, look, I agree with you. I mean, Osama bin Laden was behind the attacks, all right? That's certainly true. But let's look at it this way. Let's look at an analogy of a night watchman, all right? Let's say you got a night watchman, and he's there to guard a bank from being robbed, all right? And we got thieves, and they go to the bank, and the night watchman has fallen asleep, okay? He's fallen asleep completely. The thieves robbed the bank. Now, I agree. They are responsible. The thieves are responsible for robbing the bank. But don't you think the night watchman bears some personal responsibility, Mr. President?
Here's what I feel about that.
Okay.
The person responsible for the attacks was Osama bin Laden.
Right, but do you understand my analogy of the night watchman, Mr. President? I mean, aren't you partly responsible for not reading all the warnings that you got?
That's who's responsible for killing Americans.
Yeah, okay, all right. You've made your point, Mr. President. But the night watchman analogy, I mean, don't you think, again, that that's some responsibility?
Was Osama bin Laden.
Okay, fine. All right, fine. Osama bin Laden. Okay, fine. Look, let's move on then. Let's talk about the stuff that you had. There was a presidential daily brief on August 6th. Okay, that warned you. It was titled, Bin Laden Determined to Strike in the United States. Did you get the brief? I mean, did you read it?
In the what's called the PDB.
Yes.
There was a warning about Bin Laden's desires on America.
Exactly.
But frankly, I didn't think that was anything new.
Nothing new, Mr. President. They talked about hijacking airplanes. All right. They talk about hijacking airplanes. They specifically mentioned in the PDB that bin Laden wanted revenge on the World Trade Center. World Trade Center, the only place mentioned in the PDB, specific place. They also mentioned a terrorist in Lower Manhattan, and they mentioned an attack on Washington, D.C. I mean, didn't that maybe wake you up and try to bring you back from your golf game a little?
And the answer is that had I had any inkling whatsoever that the people were going to fly airplanes into buildings, we would have moved heaven and earth to save the country, just like we're working hard to prevent a further attack.
Yeah, but Mr. President, that's called an inkling, all right? I mean, I don't know what an inkling is. I don't know what an inkling is, but wouldn't you think that the presidential daily briefing, that is an inkling? Huh? What do you think? That's kind of a clue when they say bin Laden determined to attack the United States and they mention the Trade Center in Washington, New York. Is that an inkling?
As I mentioned, I oftentimes think about what I could have done differently.
Okay, all right.
I can assure the American people that had we had any inkling that this was going to happen, we would have done everything in our power to stop the attack.
Mr. President, that is an inkling. Look, George Tenet, director of the CIA, and I don't like George Tenet. I think he's been a complete failure, all right? I'll just say that right at the outset. I think you should have fired him. But George Tenet said that he knew about Musawi. He knew about the 20th hijacker, the guy that didn't want to learn how to take off or land planes, but just wanted to learn how to fly them, the guy that had radical al-Qaeda ties. He knew about them. He met with you every single day. Now, look, either he told you about it or he didn't. If he didn't tell you about it, I would think you'd fire him. And if he did tell you about it, well, I guess that's why you have him here. Did you meet with George Tenet? Did you talk with him?
I met with Tenet all the time. I obviously met with my principals a lot.
But you met with your principals, but you didn't have any meetings about terrorism. You had 40 principal meetings in the first 8 months. You talked about everything, stem cell research and abortion and missile defense. You never talked about terrorism.
As a lot. We talked about threats that have emerged. We had a counterterrorism group meeting on a regular basis to analyze the threats that came in. Had there been a threat that required action by anybody in the government, I would have dealt with it. In other words, had they come up and said, this is where we see something happening, you can rest assured that the people of this government would have responded, and responded in a forceful way.
In other words, if Osama bin Laden had sent you, Mr. President, an engraved invitation, Dear George, on September 11, 2001, at 9 a.m., we're going to hit the World Trade Center.
Yes.
And we're going to do it at 20 to 9 in the morning, and it's going to be these four flights.
Yeah.
And we're going to have these terrorists on the flights.
Yeah.
And, we're gonna take off at this time, and we're gonna use these knives to get around the security measures.
Yeah.
And we're gonna use these, immigration violations to get in.
Yeah.
If you'd have all that information, then, along with the engraved invitation signed Osama, then you would have done something about it?
Yes.
Okay, alright. Then you would have done something. Okay, well that's good. I'm glad to know that there's something that would make you do something about it,
But there was nobody in our government, at least, and I don't think the prior government, that could envision flying airplanes into buildings on such a massive scale.
Well, how about on a minor scale? I mean, it was in your PDB, folks. Mr. President, the Presidential Daily Brief specifically mentioned hijackings. How about on a minor scale? Mr. President? Look, Nervous Ed, why don't you ask him the question? Because obviously I'm not getting through to him. Nervous Ed, ask him about the Daily Brief and the hijackings in there.
Ed.
Mr. President, good evening. I'd like to ask you about the August 6th PDB.
Sure.
You mentioned it at Fort Hood on Sunday. You pointed out that it did not warn of a hijacking of airplanes to crash into buildings, but
right.
that it warned of hijacking to obviously take hostages and to secure the release of extremists being held by the U.S. Did that trigger some specific actions on your part in the administration, since it dealt with potentially hundreds of lives and a blackmail attempt on the United States government?
Yeah. No, I'm sorry.
Well, okay, that's about the most honest thing you've said today. Okay, you just didn't do anything and you're sorry. That's important. Because usually you don't make. Oh, you're not sorry. You're just sorry you can't answer the question. All right. Well, let's move on then. Let me ask you about other countries. Again, it's one of my crack team reporters, John. You want to ask the president a question about how other countries are helping?
You mentioned that 17 of the 26 NATO members are providing some help on the ground in Iraq, but if you look at the numbers, 135,000 U.S. troops, 10 or 12,000 British troops, then the next largest, perhaps even the second largest contingent of guns on the ground are private contractors, literally hired guns. Your critics, including your Democratic opponents, say that's proof to them your coalition is window dressing. How would you answer those critics? And can you assure the American people that post-sovereignty, when the handover takes place, that there will be more burden sharing by allies in terms of security forces?
Yeah. John, my response is I don't think people ought to demean the contributions of our friends into Iraq.
You have a point, Mr. President. You have a point. I've actually been particularly honored by the contribution that Tonga has had to make. Tonga and its troop, his name is Jose, and Tonga's troop, Jose, that has come in and helped us do a lot of the cooking, really good Caribbean food cooking for at least 40 or 50 of our troops. I want to thank the contribution of Tonga. I really don't mean to demean Tonga or the Tonga nation in any way. I understand that it's kind of like a pizza. And if you cut a pizza into 8 slices, well, we control 7 of those slices in Iraq. And then the 8th slice, well, you can split that one in half. And half of that slice would be the British. And half of that slice, that sliver of pizza, well, that's all the other countries, including Tonga's troop, Jose. So, I agree. We really shouldn't demean the contributions of everybody else just because we have to hire mercenaries, hire contractors to do our shooting for us because we can't get enough nations to do that. I don't in any way take that from your leadership, Mr. President, because, you know, other presidents, they could get the world to stand behind them. But, you know, you have shown that America's different. You've shown that we can stand firm and we can be stubborn and we don't need the world. We can just invade every country on earth. And even if it requires a draft, even if it requires, you know, 100 Americans dead a month, you stand firm. You don't depend on those horrible other countries. You don't act French like John Kerry. And so, Mr. President, I got to give you a lot of credit. Hey, we're going to go to a commercial break. If you want to come back and you want to call in and find out what you think about my interview, the number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. You can also email me by sending an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. When we come back, my interview with George Bush continues, and we ask him the difficult question of whether Iraq is becoming like Vietnam. You won't want to miss his response. Again, call in 877-57-SCOOP or just listen in. We'll be back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
Notice that one of the Bushites' favorite words is robust. It implies vigor, action, power. It's a manly sort of word that they punch out of their mouths like a fist. They've been using the word a lot lately to buff up George's image as an unrelenting foe of terrorism who's battling every aspect of the global terrorist network. The president is robust in his commitment, they bark at anyone who dares question Bush's actions or inactions. Yet there's one aspect of battling terrorism that the Bushites have gotten downright wimpy about: tracking down the money that finances the global network. While George himself has talked big about rooting out the evildoers who put the money up for terrorist attacks, this is not an area that the big banks and some of our supposed allies really want to have deeply investigated. So Bush very quietly zeroed out a request by the IRS to increase by half the number of investigators it has to follow the money trail of terrorism. This is painstaking work that requires substantial staff with the expertise, time, and backing to do the job. But in his latest budget, which George hailed as evidence of his robust pursuit of the bad guys, there is zero funding for the 80 additional criminal investigators requested by the IRS. This would not have come to light at all, except that it was mentioned in one sentence on the last page of a routine report to an obscure congressional subcommittee by an even more obscure IRS oversight board. Bush's defunding of IRS's financial diggers was caught by one alert committee member, Representative Earl Pomeroy, who has since been directing some very robust questions to the White House. This is Jim Hightower saying, a Bush PR flack responded that the Treasury Department, of which the IRS is a part, got an overall budget increase, which she says demonstrates Bush's robust commitment to tracking terrorist money. But since that still doesn't get the IRS the agents it needs, I'd call that a robust dodge.
Federal college loan rates are currently lower than they have ever been, which means by refinancing now, you could cut your monthly student loan payment by up to 50%. By calling 1-800-2-COLLEGE, you'll quickly be connected to College Loan Corporation. We will answer your questions, help you lower your payments, and secure a rate as low as 2.63%. It's easy, it's free, and so far, over 300,000 people have called. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
It's night. You have heartburn. You want fast relief. Zantac works fast. When first used, Prilosec OTC works not so fast. Zantac works right when you need it.
Hello, relief.
Prilosec's label says it may take 1 to 4 days to fully work. So, what would you choose?
Estimated time of relief, 1 to 4 days.
Prilosec, nah. Zantac's for people who hate to wait, especially at night. Use as directed.
We're back here on the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. And we've got a really amazing guest on the program this hour. His name is George Walker Bush. He's the son of a president, George Herbert Walker Bush, and he is president of the United States. Indeed, he's the first president in American history not to be chosen by the voters. Despite the fact that he was rejected by the voters of the United States of America and the voters of Florida, he was installed by his daddy's good friend, Antonin Scalia, and four others. And that makes him really quite special. He's our first appointed president and really, in essence, our first king. Prince George has ruled for more than 3 years now. And though it takes his daddy's advisors to tell him what to do, he does cut quite a figure. He likes to wear a flight suit. He looks quite good in it. He likes to go and be with horses on his ranch. You know, the last person I think that did as good a job with cows and horses was Marie Antoinette. She actually went to milk cows on her golden milk school to show the peasants of France that she too really cared. And our Prince George Bush is the same. When he clears the shrubs, he shows America what's really important, because he's showing that he's an ordinary one. He's one of them. He's not going to be disturbed with questions about whether we're going to be attacked by terrorists. No. He's going to clear that brush. He's going to ride the horses. He's going to show that he is just like every macho guy in America. God bless our president, George W. Bush. But, Mr. President, again, I want to thank you very much for coming on the program. I know that you hate the press, that you hate press conferences, that you don't like to answer questions without Dick Cheney by your side. And that's why I'm really honored that you would take the time away from raising hundreds of millions of dollars, away from meeting with polluters and lobbyists, to be on my show, The Inside Scoop. Thank you again. Thank you for being on the show. I want to turn, though, to one of my other reporters here. She's got a tough question for you, Mr. President, and it has to do with the connection between Iraq and Vietnam.
Mr. President, April is turning into the deadliest month in Iraq since the fall of Baghdad. And
She has a low voice. Excuse me. April, I'm sorry. We're letting John go first. Okay, John, you're asking the question. There you go.
Mr. President, April is turning into the deadliest month in Iraq since the fall of Baghdad, and some people are comparing Iraq to Vietnam and talking about a quagmire. Polls show that support for your policy is declining and that fewer than half Americans now support it. What does that say to you, and how do you answer the Vietnam comparison?
You know, and I want to add, Mr. President, because I think it's a tough question. You know, in Vietnam, when we were sending hundreds of thousands of Americans over there, when we had 50,000 deaths and young people were up in arms, they wanted to say that, you know, the Vietnam War was wrong, and they came out and said it, and the people who supported the war in Vietnam called them unpatriotic, said that they were, you know, these Americans that wanted to basically to send our troops home, that they were anti-American. And I want to praise you, Mr. President, because you would never do that. You would never say that just because we don't approve of your war in Iraq, that somehow we were anti-American, Mr. President. And I want to praise you for that.
I think the analogy is false. I also happen to think that analogy sends the wrong message to our troops and sends the wrong message to the enemy.
Really? So you think we are unpatriotic if we disagree with you? Wow. Look, but how is the analogy false, Mr. President? I mean, Vietnam was hard work, right? I mean, Vietnam was a nation that was strangled by tyranny, you might say. It was not a free country, and yet they didn't want us to be there anyway. You tell us the analogy is false. Please tell us how Iraq is different from Vietnam.
Look, this is hard work.
So is Vietnam.
It's hard to advance freedom in a country that has been strangled by tyranny.
That was my point, Mr. President. Can you give us a specific reason why we need to be in Iraq?
And yet we must stay the course, because the end result is in our nation's interest.
Because the end result is in our nation's interest. Okay. Well, now, how is it in our nation's interest?
A secure and free Iraq is an historic opportunity to change the world and make America more secure.
Well, there you go. You heard it first here on the Inside Scoop, folks. A secure Iraq and a free Iraq can change the world and make America more secure. Who can argue with that? Who can argue with that? We change the world, we make America more secure. Anyone that would be against that would obviously be a communist, right?
A free Iraq in the midst of a the Middle East will have incredible change.
Well, you know, you're right. A free Iraq would be incredible. It'd be incredible in the Middle East to have a free Iraq. But what if the people don't vote for freedom? I mean, it seems to me like the people that are going to get the most votes right now are the people supported by Iran, the religious leaders that are very strongly anti-American. If they vote to take away women's rights, to have a theocracy in Iraq, then will we still have all those good things that you promise us?
It's hard. Freedom is not easy to achieve. I mean, it's.
Oh, okay. Well, it's not easy, right? But are we getting anywhere here?
And we're making progress. There's no question. It's been a tough series of weeks for the American people. It's been really tough for the families. I understand that. It's been tough on this administration. But we're doing the right thing.
Well, there you go, folks. We're doing the right thing. I mean, we're doing the right thing. We're changing the world. We're making America more secure. This is the president that doesn't speak in generalities. He gives specifics, you know? And this is the president who, you know, he listens to the American people.
You know, and as to whether or not I make decisions based upon polls, I don't. I just don't make decisions that way. I fully understand the consequences of what we're doing.
And what are we doing, Mr. President? Since you fully understand the consequences, what are the consequences of what we're doing?
We're changing the world. And the world will be better off, and America will be more secure as a result of the actions we're taking.
Okay, we're changing the world. America's more secure. I mean, again, that makes perfect sense. When do you plan to tell us how you plan to make the world more secure and America change and all this good stuff? You plan to get around and telling us anytime soon?
One of the things that's very important, Judy.
My name's Mark, Mr. President. My name's Mark.
As far as I'm concerned, is to never allow our youngsters to die in vain.
Well, you know, that argument was made exactly in Vietnam. Argument was made in Vietnam that people shouldn't die in vain. And yet, when you think about it, it's really a foolish argument, isn't it, Mr. President? I mean, let's say we declare war on Albania or Sweden or Canada or, I don't care, Tonga, although Jose's helping us so much. I hate to declare war on Tonga. But let's say we declare war on Tonga and we go in there and Americans die, okay? And some of us argue that that our troops shouldn't be in Tonga, that Jose was really helpful to us, that maybe we shouldn't be invading Tonga and they should come home. You could make the argument that, no, we have to stay there because to do otherwise would allow our youngsters to die in vain. Do you see now, Mr. President, that it's really not a very good argument that you could invade any country and then say, oh, no, we can't have our youngsters die in vain? That really, that doesn't tell you whether it's a good policy or not, Mr. President?
Is to never allow our youngsters to die in vain.
Well, that's my point, Mr. President. Please.
And I made that pledge to their parents. Withdrawing from the battlefield of Iraq would be just that.
But are we ever going to leave? I mean, is this ever going to be over?
And it's not going to happen under my watch. And we're not going to leave. We're going to do the job. And a free Iraq is going to be a major blow for terrorism. It'll change the world.
It'll change the world. You know, I don't know how you argue with that. It'll change the world. There's the answer. And again, when do you plan on telling us how you're going to change the world?
I plan on telling the American people that I've got a plan to win the war on terror.
You plan on telling the American people that you've got a plan to win the war on terror. Terrific. When do you plan on telling us that you've got a plan to win the war on terror? I mean, don't you think it's about time that you told us now? You know, Mr. President, I think we've been there a while. I think it's about time. I mean, we're seeing all these dead Americans. Don't you think you ought to, hey, fill us in on the plan?
Look, nobody likes to see dead people on their television screens. I don't. It's a tough time for the American people to see that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, obviously when people are dying like the genocide in Sudan and it's not on television screens, you know, I understand that you don't care. But again, just please, Mr. President, you said you're going to change the world. Okay. How are you going to change the world? How will the world change? Why is it important? Can you at least tell our troops why we're in Iraq?
I also know that there's an historic opportunity here to change the world. And it's very important for the loved ones of our troops to understand that the mission is an important, vital mission for the security of America and for the ability to change the world for the better.
Well, there you have it, folks. You've got the answer that you've been looking for. You have the specifics on why we're in Iraq. It's to change the world and to make America more secure. And I don't know how anyone can't be satisfied with that. But if you're not, if you want to comment on my interview with George Bush, please do. The number is 877-57-SCOOP. Toll free, 877-57-SCOOP. You can also email me by sending an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. When we come back, I'm going to ask the president two more questions. One has to do with our troops in Iraq, how many will be there, and how long they'll be there. And the other has to do with whether our president ever makes a mistake. You won't want to miss my interview with President George W. Bush coming up right after these messages.
Job growth surges in March, blared the headlines, and what a rose-colored rush of self-congratulation ensued. George W. gloated like the boy who stuck in his thumb and pulled out a plum. Economists were high-fiving each other. Editorialists hailed the new boom. And you would have thought the bluebird of happiness was singing in every backyard. But even as Bush strutted atop a made-for-TV platform that his staff had emblazoned with the slogan, Strengthening America's Economy, the whole scene had a false feel to it, eerily similar to George's strut in his Top Gun costume last year aboard that aircraft carrier that his staff had emblazoned with the declaration, Mission Accomplished in Iraq. Just as our troops are still mired in that bloody war, so are most Americans still mired in a low-wage economy that can't be fixed by presidential strut. For the powers that be to celebrate the addition of 300,000 jobs is ludicrous in an economy that has lost more than 2 million jobs since Bush took office and that continues to offshore our best-paying jobs. If you peek beneath the headlines, you'll find that the number of out-of-work Americans actually went up by 200,000 in March, and the number of underemployed, those wanting full-time work but only getting part-time jobs, was up by 300,000. Also, of the ballyhooed new jobs that Bush claims to have created in March, nearly 50,000 are not new at all. They're the jobs of California supermarket workers who had been on strike and have now returned to their old jobs. Worse, what Bush and the powers that be don't want us noticing is that nearly all of March's job creation was in low-wage, no-benefit work that cannot sustain a middle-class way of life. Indeed, despite the gloating over March's job stats, average weekly earnings went down in March. This is Jim Hightower saying, the real issue is not job numbers, but the decline in good jobs, the very lifeblood of America's middle class.
Federal college loan rates are currently lower than they have ever been, which means by refinancing now, you could cut your monthly student loan payment by up to 50%. By calling 1-800-2-COLLEGE, you'll quickly be connected to College Loan Corporation. We will answer your questions, help you lower your payments, and secure a rate as low as 2.63%. It's easy, it's free, and so far, over 300,000 people have called. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
While you can't see brilliant colors on the radio, you can use them in your business. That's why the Xerox WorkCenter M24 digital color copier printer is attractive to anyone who listens to the voice of reason. The lease price is a low $189 a month. You get brilliant Xerox color for less than 9 cents a page, plus the Xerox Total Satisfaction Guarantee. To get all the colors you can't see on the radio, do the most reasonable thing.
Call 1-800-ASK-XEROX for business lease details. Additional per copy charge.
We're back here on The Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, interviewing the President of the United States, George W. Bush, our first president not chosen by the Electoral College, not chosen by the American people, but chosen by five members of the Supreme Court. People argue that African Americans don't like George W. Bush, but he got 100% of the African American vote that mattered. That being, of course, Justice Clarence Thomas. Only 9 people got to vote for our president. 5 chose him, and he's there, and he's answering my questions. And if you want to ask me questions or pose questions to our guest, it's kind of hard to do, but you can try. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP. You can also send me an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and President George W. Bush. How are you?
Hey, I'm fine.
What's your first name and where are you calling from?
I am Osama from Illinois.
Osama from Illinois. Wow. Did you come in to talk about your endorsement of the president?
I have been here for some time. I want to know why George Bush does not come see me. I told him where I am. I'm driving cab in Chicago. And I challenge him to a Mud Wrestle Smackdown of death.
You know, I would think...
He refuses.
I know. I would think after your endorsement of him today, or yesterday...
He is cowardly.
Yeah, you know, I think he'd come after you, but and at least say hello. I mean, he came on my show, which really surprised me, because I'm a real critic of the administration. You're right. I think he would come to visit, but apparently he hasn't.
I will meet him at the airport.
Okay, well, you know, hang on.
I'll be at O'Hare.
Fair enough. Okay, Osama, you be at O'Hare. That's good. Do me a favor. While you're at O'Hare, don't go on any planes, please. Because I'd feel better if you just stay away from the planes. Is that okay?
I'm learning how.
Okay.
To fly.
Well, that's what scares me.
But I can't take off on land.
Well, hang on, Osama. I want to continue my interview with George W. Bush. Hang on, and we'll talk to you after the interview is over.
I'm sorry, but the FBI agents are getting closer.
Yeah. Well, I hope they do. I hope they do find you and talk to you. Hey, that was Osama apparently from Illinois calling in. If you haven't heard, Al Qaeda. And this, by the way, with all my amusement, this is true. I'm not making this up, folks. Osama and Al-Qaeda really did endorse the reelection of President George W. Bush. This was reported in the New Yorker magazine just a couple days ago. They said they endorsed him because Bush acts with force rather than wisdom or shrewdness, and is his religious fanaticism that will rouse our nation, as has been shown. But I want to continue my interview with George W. Bush. I want to ask him about the troops, and sometimes he responds best to some of the other reporters. So, John, why don't you ask the president your question?
What's your best prediction on how long U.S. troops will have to be in Iraq? And it sounds like you will have to add some troops. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, first of all, that's up to General Abizaid, and he's clearly indicating that he may want more troops. It's coming up to the chain of command, and if that's what he wants, that's what he gets.
Now, Mr. President, now, we had a general before. His name's Eric Shinseki, and he said before the war that we would need 100,000 troops in Iraq, and at which point all your administration, Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld, called Shinseki a fool, basically attacked him mercilessly, because you said that's all up to the generals to decide who goes, right? That's not the general's decision. It's the president's decision, and you thought we would nowhere near 100,000 troops. Have you changed your mind on this?
Well, first of all, that's up to General Abizaid, and he's clearly indicating that he may want more troops. It's coming up to the chain of command, and if that's what he wants, that's what he gets. Generally, we've had about 115,000 troops in Iraq. There's 135,000 now as a result of the changeover from one division to the next. If he wants to keep troops there to help, I'm more than willing to say yes, General Abizaid. I talk to General Abizaid quite frequently.
Well, is the answer really that you just don't like General Shinseki? I mean, you talk to General Abizaid because, you know, you like hanging out with him. Maybe he's a drinking buddy. I don't know. But you just don't like General Shinseki. That was the problem? It's just the wrong general? Is that the problem?
Quite frequently.
Yeah, okay, all right. You talk with General Abizaid. Hey, look, let me just ask you, Mr. President. I think it's a fair question. We've got Americans that have their sons and daughters in Iraq, and they want to know how long they're going to be there. And I think it's a fair question. You don't have to give us an exact time frame, but about how long do you expect us to have troops in Iraq?
In terms of how long we'll be there, as long as necessary, and not one day more.
Okay. Well, there's my answer. Americans, as long as necessary, but not one day more. You know, that's a great answer, Mr. President, because it's not too short a time, it's as long as necessary. And yet, it's not too long a time either, not one day more. Our president is giving clear, clear advice. Thank you, Mr. President. You know, that was a great answer to that question, but, you know, there's a tougher question that has to be asked, and that has to do with mistakes. I'll let another reporter ask that question of you.
One of the biggest criticisms of you is that whether it's WMD in Iraq, post-war planning in Iraq, or even the question of whether this administration did enough to ward off 9/11, you never admit a mistake. Is that a fair criticism, and do you believe that there were any errors in judgment that you made related to any of those topics I brought up?
Nope. Yeah.
Nope. Well, okay. Maybe he didn't hear the question. Let's ask it again.
After 9/11, what would your biggest mistake be, would you say, and what lessons have you learned from it?
I wish you'd have given me this written question ahead of time so I could plan for it. John, I'm sure historians will look back and say, gosh, he could have done it better this way or that way. As I mentioned, I oftentimes think about what I could have done differently. I'm sure something will pop in my head here in the midst of this press conference, all the pressure of trying to come up with an answer, but it hadn't yet. I would have gone into Afghanistan the way we went into Afghanistan. Even though what I know today about the stockpiles of weapons, I still would have called upon the world to deal with Saddam Hussein. He's a dangerous man. He's a man who actually not only had weapons of mass destruction, the reason I can say that with certainty is because he used them.
Well, and you could say that with certainty, presumably, because your father gave him those weapons, right? I mean, and so did Ronald Reagan. I mean, we armed him, and so I guess that's how we know he has the weapons.
And I have no doubt in my mind that he would like to have inflicted harm or paid people to inflict harm or trained people to inflict harm on America, because he hated us.
You know, he used to like us. He liked us back when we were giving him the chemical weapons against Iran. But I guess he hates us now, and yet he hasn't done a single action against Americans since he tried to kill your dad in 1993. But Clinton responded very harshly to that, bombed his intelligence centers, and he hasn't done anything since. But the idea is that he still harbors hate, I guess. Right, Mr. President? But let's go back to the question of mistakes, because that was the question. What mistakes have you made, Mr. President?
I don't want to sound like I've made no mistakes. I'm confident I have.
Well, me too.
Just put me under the spot here, and maybe I'm not as quick on my feet as I should be in coming up with one.
Well, maybe I can come up with one. Weapons of mass destruction, your tax cut to the rich that bankrupted everybody, the war in Iraq that you said they'd greet us as liberators with flowers. Maybe that's a mistake. Maybe your failure to find Osama bin Laden. Maybe your failure to take the presidential daily brief seriously to protect us from 9/11. How about your failure to listen to Clinton's strong warnings to worry about Al-Qaeda? How about your failure to take up the Gore Commission's report to protect airline safety? Are any of these mistakes, Mr. President? You know, do you think mistakes at all are important to know anything you did wrong?
And my fear, of course, is that this will go on for a while, and therefore it's incumbent upon us to learn from lessons or mistakes and leave behind a better foundation for presidents to deal with the threats we face. This is the war that other presidents will be facing as we head into the 21st century.
And what I have to say is that I really hope that other presidents will be facing this, because obviously, Mr. President, you have no idea what's going on. But hey, thanks for coming on my show. I'll tell you, it's not many presidents of the United States I get here on the Inside Scoop, and I know that you hate doing press conferences, and so I'm very glad that you came to my show. Hey, look, tomorrow we've got a really excellent guest. All kidding aside, we've got Elaine Kmark. She was the staff director for the Gore Commission. There really was a Gore Commission during the Clinton administration, sponsored by Vice President Al Gore, and the commission decided to protect us on airlines, improving cockpit safety, hardening cockpits, putting marshals on the ground, on the planes, actually checking passenger lists. Why is it hasn't been reported in the mainstream press, I don't know. But here on the Inside Scoop, we bring you the news that Washington doesn't want you to know. We bring you the news that's not in the mainstream media. And we're going to have tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 Central, 1 Mountain, and noon Pacific, Elaine Kmark, the staff member who ran the Gore Commission. We're going to talk about what the Gore Commission recommended and how Al Gore, if the Supreme Court had allowed the American people to decide, how Al Gore would have prevented the most severe terrorist attack in American history. You won't want to miss it tomorrow on the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine signing off.